you?
I'm okay. How are you?
Good. You are recently engaged, right?
Yes.
That's fantastic.
Late July.
Late July. Cool. When's
Yeah.
the big day?
Next July.
Next, that's a good amount of time. It's a lot of
Yeah.
weddings are a lot like it's just like a big production management job. And then also
Yeah.
you're married at the end of it. So
Yeah.
I think a long timeline is pretty good.
It will be 364 days in between engaged and married. So
Oh, nice. I like that
exactly a year.
timing.
Yeah. It was nice. It was all kind of like I started school again, so I'm not like crazy about getting married on a weekend and then going back to class. So like the summer
Right?
was the only time we had to do it. And we've been together for 8 years already, so I wasn't like super crazy about waiting 2 more. So
Yeah, okay.
just like planned it.
Just planned it. Just get it in there. Wow, 8 years. That's a long time to be
Yeah.
just I want to say living in sin. That's what I'm going to go with. It's a long time to be living in sin.
You know, not the first time, not the first time it's been said. Not
Oh
the
man, I
first
was hoping it was the first time it had been said, but
time it's been said.
I
Yep.
also should have probably thought of, known better at this point, but yeah.
You know.
Oh, well, congratulations. Way
Thank you.
to make an honest man out of him.
I as I'm sure similar in California, stuff gets expensive out here on the East Coast.
Yeah, but you're in the same area that I used to be in, right? You're at in a Baltimore suburb, is that right? Baltimore, DC, closer
Yeah,
to
I'm in
Baltimore.
Laurel. So
You're
it's
in
like right in
Laurel.
between.
I was
Yeah.
in I we owned a house in Hyattsville before we moved.
Oh,
Yeah,
yeah.
and the sale of that house is what kept us living in California up until what day is it? The 22nd? Up until 7 days ago when we withdrew the last of our savings.
Yeah.
Yay. But we did benefit from right before we moved the first Whole Foods in Prince George's County was opening up about a mile away from us. And we're like, oh, coincidentally, it's time for us to get the hell out of here. So yay, thanks, Whole Foods. Bye.
Well, now they just built a brand new Whole Foods in Riverdale Park, like right down the street from the university. And so this is
Yeah, that's
like,
the one. That was the one that was right by my house.
It's crazy. Now it's like a whole shopping town center with like District Taco
Oh
and
man. See,
yeah.
so the downside is I missed out on being there for District Taco, but the upside is that I didn't have to pay District Taco prices when I got there. So good for me.
Yeah.
So we're rolling. We have been. So that was
Great.
all chitter chatter. And if there's anything that it needs to be off the record, we'll do that. But welcome. I
I'm
can go
so
back
excited.
and take things out if you don't want anybody to know that you've been living in sin for 8 years. slash are engaged. That's amazing. Hey, I'm really glad to have you here.
I'm so excited to be here. Thank you for asking.
Yeah. So we've got Lindsay Barr on with us today. I know her mostly as our administrator at Literary Managers and Dramaturgs of the Americas. So she's our one proper year-round employee, and the rest of us are volunteer board members and etc.ers. But Lindsay's the one who's like in it to win it. And for her, we are eternally grateful. But you're also shockingly a dramaturg as well, which is how you came to be involved in such an organization. Can you tell me what's on your business card? You're just generico. Hi, I'm Lindsay. Here's what I'm about.
Gosh, that's such a good question. I like to say, no, in practicality it might be different, but I like to say that I am an arts administrator, dramaturg, director.
Okay, yeah, that's good. Arts administrator, dramaturg, director. And when people are like, what is a dramaturg? What's your definition when people ask what is dramaturgy?
I typically tend to break it down into two super macro levels of like new play dramaturgy and production dramaturgy, just because it seems like the most digestible for people who aren't particularly familiar. So I like to say, like, there are different types of dramaturgy, but largely there are these two camps, and one of them is new play dramaturgy, and then go through, you know, that's a little bit more working through the script as it exists and trying to figure out, like, what works and what doesn't work, and, like, working with the playwright one-on-one. And then I like to describe production dramaturgy as any myriad of things that can occur. But one that I like to talk about most is just providing, like, the contextual research for the world of the play as it exists, as the playwright has written it. And I always use the example, I just worked on Dancing at Lunasa at Everyman. And so I say, like, you know, that play takes place in 1936 Ireland. And in order for us to understand what that was like, you need someone to come in and say, these are all the things that, you know, kind of existed at that time, both sociopolitically as well as just tactically, right? Like, where did they store their food in 1936 London? I mean, Ireland, rather.
Yeah, I like tech. I haven't heard it described as what's going on tactically, but that seems really instructive and useful, and a lot of what we do is just like looking at the pantry on stage and being like, that's not right. Get some different grains in there, dude.
Well, and I think, you know, what was interesting when I was working on Dancing with Lunasa is that the actors particularly wanted, and I think that was really a privilege of the process of this particular cast, but they wanted to know, right? Like, a character is on stage cutting bread and buttering bread. Like, where would they have gotten that butter from? Is it a cellar? Is it a fridge? Because those are very, like, how you interact with that is very different. So that's what I kind of use as my just conversation starter with what production dramaturgy can be.
That sounds like a good group of inquisitive actors too.
Yeah, they really were.
I kind of came, so I have a performance background. That's what I started off as an actor, and then became in undergrad a pretty good acting coach as a directing student, because still I'm so, I don't get design, like, anything that it's part of it. There's part of my brain that's like, this is too much like putting together IKEA furniture. I can't do it. I shut off. I've got like math anxiety about the whole thing. So my direction tends to be like, if I've got a good team, great, we're gonna knock it out of the park. But the strength is definitely more in It was in describing and illuminating the world of the play so that the actors could, especially for undergrads, could say their lines intelligently. And so I didn't realize that was such a slippery slope into dramaturgy. Mm. And that was really what I was doing as a director, but I just didn't have the vocabulary for it. But there is a marked difference in the quality of performance between actors who know their shit, like know it, and those who have memorized their you know, let's say Shakespeare lines, because, you know, I'm thinking back to my undergrad, we all have to direct a scene from Midsummer days.
You know what's so interesting about that is that I actually came to like, I come from a design background, which not a lot of people know.
Very cool.
Yeah. Like, I should use that term very loosely, design background, quote unquote. So I was in high school and was like, you know, in high school, we all did the acting thing. So we like, we're concerned, like, great, we want to be performers and we're great at this and this is amazing. And then I quickly learned that I didn't want to be a performer, and I have great respect for performers and actors and what they can do. I'm just not someone who can just like throw all caution to the wind in the name of, like, you know, sometimes rolling around on the floor. Like, that's just so not in my wheelhouse. And so I went to college, and I went to Towson University in just was north of Baltimore. And at Towson, there are three tracks you can be on in the program. You're an acting major, you're a design and production person, or you're a theater studies, and you have to like claim what portion of theater you're going to do.
Study.
And so I knew I didn't want to be an actor, so I didn't pursue the acting track, and I wasn't really sure what else I would do in theater if it weren't for design. So I actually went to Towson and have a degree in design and production, completed all the requirements, and it was through there that, you know, halfway through I had to take an elective, and one of the electives was dramaturgy. And I was my first semester in by the great Robin Quick, who like is an amazing professor and dramaturg and just all around scholar. In my first semester junior year, I was like, oh, this is really interesting. And like, I'm not incredibly passionate about design, but I'm really passionate about theater. So like, how can I use those skills that come from design and skills that come from performing into kind of playing a part in theater that fits my skill set and my interests? And that's just kind of ended up in dramaturgy. And so the last 2 years of my undergrad experience were just like trying to jam in the theater studies curriculum while I was finishing up the design and production. So I have two tracks on my degree, which is really nice. But I, so strangely, I kind of came through it through design, which is not common.
Yeah, well, I'm learning as I'm interviewing people. It's more common than I had thought, because I had been thinking of it as a separate thing. But I do know that like I can get really wrapped around the axle in a good way on, say, sound design and like trying to find like what's like, man, I can spend so much time in the Library of Congress audio archives being like, okay, well, I just need like some lobby music. Let me spend 36 hours straight finding everything that was a popular hit in that town in 1911. Here we go. And so it's very easy to like, you know, all those sensory ways of making the world authentic are a much more powerful entree into dramaturgy than I had been giving it credit for. So I've had a few talks with people who have come from set design and sound design backgrounds in particular, and you know, like in the last 10 days or so, I've been like, oh yes, that makes perfect sense. Obviously all designers are to some extent dramaturgs, but it just hadn't clicked with me. That's the magic of this podcast, talking to people, asking questions. So was there anything that you were designing in particular that kind of clicked for you as kind of the, like, oh shit, I'm making a world moment? By the way, we do swear on this podcast. I should always tell people this before we start recording. You don't have to swear if that's not your jam. I'm just letting you know so that you don't have to, like, hold it in if you're feeling it.
You know, it's really funny because Towson is a very, of course I'm biased, but I think Towson is a very good program, and it's a very strong program in both the, now they have BFA in acting. It wasn't a BFA when I was there, but, and a BS for both design and then theater studies. And the people in the design track are very, very talented, far more talented than I ever was as any type of designer. So I never reached the point in my career where they were like letting me design stuff because people were so much better than I was. But it was interesting because we did this dramaturgy. I did this dramaturgy elective, and the show that we were working on together as like a team, the class would act as some type of dramaturgy team, was George Brandt's Elephant's Graveyard.
Okay. And that's a show I've heard of, but have not read or seen. So you can tell me more.
It's a great one. And with, to go even farther back, for our script analysis, that is the first class you take in the, you know, the curriculum at Towson. And it's really just, you know, really deep textual analysis based on David Ball's backwards and forwards and just like how do plays operate? What is a trigger? What is a heap? All that, you know, great stuff that David Ball is really great at explaining. And we actually, because the professor of that, Dr. David White, was really great friends with George Brandt, we read a lot of George Brandt's lesser known things. Now George Brandt's a huge name because Grounded is like amazing and it's everywhere. But at the time, he wasn't as well known because Grounded had not yet come into our lives. And we read Elephant's Graveyard. And what's great about Elephant's Graveyard is that it is told through a series of monologues from these 10 different characters, maybe. And they're all direct addressed to the audience. They don't really speak to each other. And it's about this 1933, I think, is the year where a circus came to town in Irwin, Tennessee, and a elephant killed someone. And so they hung the elephant.
Oh, Jesus.
It ramps up. And so it's just like this really massive, very macro look of like, how do we reconcile when things that are, you know, when we're faced with these things that we're not aware of, and how do we deal with these tragedies? But also on top of it, like, it was 1933 in Irwin, Tennessee, so there are racial tensions, and like, there are people who see this elephant as a symbol of, you know, grandiose and everything we don't have, and what does that mean when we hang that? And it's really kind of layered and very deep, and it should be performed more often because I think it's really great. So all that to say.
That stresses me out. It sounds fascinating and stressful. And how do you hang an elephant? I don't want to know. I don't want to.
Tell you. So there's that background. There was a really deep, like the DNA of this play was deep within the program because we all studied George Brandt and we were all really familiar with the play. So we were producing it. It was being done. And Dr. David White was directing it. And so our dramaturgy class was responsible for kind of digging deep into this world. And I was the lead on the project. From the class, and that's kind of how I got into it. I just kind of started taking these. It was a moment in my mind where it kind of connected that artistic license can still have really incredible merit and still have really incredibly deep DNA within actual events, but present them in a way that is totally different and or easier for us to recognize. And it was through that that I was looking through the play and I was like, oh, this character of the marshal who has no sympathy for the fact that this elephant has killed someone and is, you know, kind of gung-ho about making sure that this elephant dies. You know, I could go into the archives of Irvine, Tennessee and find the marshal who was the person who said that this needs to happen. And for like that moment for me was the one where I was like, oh my gosh, like we're dealing with not only things of consequence, but things of real genealogy, real, honestly. Yeah. And that was when I was like, this is really fascinating. And I really want to be a part of learning more about this. And then turning around and presenting to the cast to say like, cool, you're playing the pastor. The pastor at this time was this human and they actually did have these beliefs. So that was a really long-winded thing to say.
No, and I dig all of it. That's why we're here. Cool. So right now you're working on another production dramaturgy project. Do you want to tell us about your current gig?
Yeah, so I'm currently working at Everyman Theater in Baltimore City. It is a professional regional theater. It's kind of small, which is really great. I kind of prefer that. But I'm the production dramaturg for Lynn Nottage's Sweat, which opens, I don't know how delayed this is going to be, but it opens on this Friday, which is October 26th, I think.
October 26th. When does it run until? Because I'll try to get the episode out in time for people to go. It'll probably be sold out, though, right? Because that's a hot ticket.
I would like to think so.
Okay.
But the Baltimore theater audience is incredibly fickle with what they...
Okay, that's fair. Good for them.
You know, want to consume. So I don't know. I think it's a really great piece, but I question how much people are going to see it. It runs through November 25th.
November 25th. Okay, I'm going to try real hard to get this episode front-loaded a little so that people can go get some tickets.
And read all the program notes.
Read all the program notes. They're going to be so good. Okay, November 27th. Great. I'm writing it down. I'm not going to see it because I live over here.
It would be quite the commute.
Okay. Great. So what do you do? So, okay, first of all, I'll tell you my limited knowledge of Sweat, which increased last night because you kindly sent me a script to read. But I know... Here's what I knew before last night.
Okay.
It's a new-ish play. It won the Pulitzer Prize. It's playing all over every major city right now. I mean, not like every major city because it hasn't, it's still new. But it's out here. It just, I think just closed at CTG and is going to ACT in San Francisco right now. Like, so I know it's doing its West Coast business. Mm-hmm. I knew it was in New York. I knew it premiered at Arena Stage in DC, right around the time that I left. So I've just been like ships passing with this play. I keep reading the reviews and I had an awareness of it as the play I was missing out on. And then when I think you put on Instagram that you were starting rehearsal, you put a picture of some dramaturgy you were doing. I'm like, oh, I gotta talk to Lindsay. And now having read the play, I'm like, oh yeah, that should get awards. So the reason I was particularly interested in talking to you about this wasn't just because this play is the hotness right now, but because you're coming in at what I see as sort of this interesting intersection between new play dramaturgy and just straight up production dramaturgy. Because I mean, the play has already been built. It's already successful. It's a finished script. But it's not like you're coming out here being like, I'm gonna, it's Romeo and Juliet and I'm the dramaturg. Like you're still introducing worlds to people that aren't necessarily in the canon. So anyway, that's what interested me. What interested you in the project and what are you actually doing?
Yeah, so for this project, the dramaturgy is a little bit, like you said, challenging in that it is at this kind of intersection of new play dramaturgy, but a very established and well-acclaimed piece of theater.
Yeah,
it's won so many awards and the Pulitzer, and, you know, it's really quite remarkable. So what's interesting is that the artistic director of Everyman Theater, Vinnie Lancisi, who is the director of the piece, really wanted to program it because he saw so many parallels between Reading, Pennsylvania, which is where the play takes place, and Baltimore, in this kind of area that seems like it has so much opportunity and geographically has so much going for it and has access to so many resources, yet there are so many things in the way of its residents succeeding, both personally and professionally. Reading, Pennsylvania, what I think is really fascinating, from 2000 to 2010, in a list you do not want to quickly catapult to the top of, quickly rose to be the second most poverty-stricken city in the country.
Damn. Okay, I have a, I have a dramaturgy question about Reading, Pennsylvania. Is that the name of a town whose railroad shows up in Monopoly?
Yes.
Because I assume there was industry to be had, and therefore Monopoly needed to get involved.
Yes.
Okay, cool.
Yep. Continue. That Reading Railroad is the one that ran through Reading, Pennsylvania, and like many cities in the Rust Belt, where industry once was king, it is no longer. There are, you know, dilapidated factories and people aren't working at all. And so, you know, with the rise of the tech bubble in the late 90s and early 2000s, so down went the industry in Reading, Pennsylvania, and thus so many of the jobs, and rose very quickly to the top of the poverty stricken list. And around this time is when Lynn Nottage started, as Lynn Nottage is wont to do for many of her pieces, a really deep dive into the community in Reading, Pennsylvania. And she went there with her longtime directing partner, Kate Oriski, and just interviewed residents over the course of 2.5 years and really just kind of figured out or had these deep conversations about what happened to them. Why aren't they working? Where are they working now? What was their experience with industry? And so I think dramaturgically speaking, the idea that it's a new play, but also that it is a play based on people's lives. Like, these stories are coming from people who have said, this happened to me and this has been my experience, knowing that these ideas might be translated into a piece of theater, which is really interesting to me.
Do you know to what extent they knew it would be fictionalized? Because it's a, you know, it's not a like a biopic. It's a what do you call that? Where you take all the pieces and put them together.
Yeah.
Composite. Man, that's a word I could never find. So it's like a composite sketch of a play, right?
Yeah. I think that the residents were, like, they knew who Lynn Nottage was and they knew her purpose in their town. And they knew that she was gathering information with the intention of writing a piece because she was commissioned by Oregon Shakespeare Festival to write the piece. So it was well aware that that would be happening. I don't know to the extent it was made clear, like, your story might be the basis for the play.
Right. Well, and I'm thinking about, you know, something like Laramie Project where Tectonic and Moises Kaufman came into Laramie, Wyoming, and and that they were taking interviews, and it was a real, like, okay, your actual words and you as a person with your first and last name are going to be a character in this play. And, you know, it was dramaturged. You know, they created a story and a structure to go with it, but, like, Catherine Connolly, you know, gave her statement, and, like, great, now the character of Catherine Connolly is going to play, I think that was the name. So that, you know, your words are a monologue now. And I don't know, I would wonder, like, if I were, personally, if I were part of an event of cultural significance and a playwright came into town and was like, I'm doing a story about your town. Will you be, would you like to be interviewed? I would have in my mind, like, oh God, is there going to be, and here's Kate Langsdorf talking about her past employer, like.
Well, and I wonder if they see it as a moment of cultural significance, right? Because I think for a lot of people in this instance, and I think a lot about Lynn Nottage's play Ruined when I think about this piece, which, you know, she went to Africa and had these really challenging and difficult conversations with women who were subject to genital mutilation. And so, like, I don't know. I wonder if they see it as a cultural moment, or I wonder if they see themselves as a victim of you know, the lack of industrialization that's happening in this country. And I think the artistic director, which also was a point that particularly interested me, was this idea of, in the political climate that we currently have, a lot of the people who live in Reading, Pennsylvania are the people who feel forgotten, are the people who feel that the country is leaving them behind because they're not, they don't care about these factories, is their perception, right?
Right. Or unseen, you know, other characters who are not at the factory who in my reading of that in the play was that they felt like they were not being seen by the members of the town who worked in this industry. And so,
yeah.
unheard, unheard and unseen and forgotten.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I think what this play does so well and is so incredibly timely, a lot of, so many major publications, particularly the New York Times, claimed this as the first play of the Trump era. Because it is, I think it represents a group of people who have a heavy influence and or are heavily influenced by the rhetoric that people are being left behind in this country, and that things are being done to them by the other. And the other is very scary, I think, to these people who are losing their jobs, as I imagine it would be. So that was really particularly fascinating. Of, you know, I think many of us, particularly in dramaturgy and theater, have been very fortunate in that we found ourselves in areas where we've been accepted, and we have projects, and we have a community that we feel very strongly about that supports us. And I think there are more people in this country than we understand who don't have that, and or don't believe that they have that. I think this is a play that kind of talks about that.
Two things about what you just said that I want to highlight. First, I thought it was interesting that it is being looked at as a play about the Trump administration, because it so clearly, you know, begins right before the election of George W. Bush and ends right as that administration is coming to a close. So it reads like a history of the Bush administration and how that impacted Reading, Pennsylvania, but does seem relevant right now. And then the second part was something that I forgot because I can't keep two thoughts in my head at once, but maybe it'll come back. So, you know, keep talking.
Okay. I think another thing that's really interesting when you read the script is in the stage directions for every single scene, because it is a nonlinear piece for people who aren't incredibly familiar. They give like news headlines that were happening on that day. So it will say like, you know, the news headline for the day is George W. Bush is giving this particular speech at this summit talking about this. And that was really interesting because my immediate question as a dramaturg is, how much of that does the audience know? How much of that do the characters know?
Yeah, because in the script, as you're saying, it's just, it's the scene opens up and it's like stage directions that this is in the news. So as the dramaturg, as the director, as the production team, how did y'all decide? Like, does this newspaper headline get projected onto the wall? Is it in the programming notes? Like, where does that information go? Or do you just have to trust that the audience is going to kind of remember what July 17th of 2000 was like?
Yeah, I mean, I think what's great about Linnottage's writing is that I think you can understand everything that's happening without having that explicitly stated for you. And I don't think it's common in many productions to have that shown. I take it much more as like, I take the headlines to be an extension of the design, right? Like, I think that if we're talking about the world of the play, I don't know that, this is my own thought and the director can certainly disagree, but I don't know that we need to know exactly what headline was happening on July 17th, 2000 to understand that the feeling in the country at that time was this. And I think that those can come across in different ways. So I don't believe that the headlines will be displayed. And I don't think that's particularly common with many productions.
Okay. That was one of my biggest production questions. Because again, I have not seen a production of it, but there are, I could see it going so many ways and all of it being so, useful in either shaping or not shaping the narrative. But you're right, it is a story about those people, and and that's, that story is going to be the same. It's just the context of what's going on, but their story is going to be the same no matter what is the headline that day. So you are getting ready to open. What does your job look like this week?
With this particular director, he's much more interested in front loading dramaturgy things. So I did an actor packet, I did the articles for the program, and have largely been pretty hands off since. I mean, that's just his personal style, which is totally fine by me. When I was working with Dancing at Lunasa, which is the show I did at Everyman right before this one, that director was much more interested in having a dramaturg come in during tech week and, you know, help clarify some moments that might not be exactly as salient as they would want, or just come in as a third party to just have a very objective view of what they're seeing on stage. So that's what I did for the last show. But for this one, the director is much more interested in having information available than having a dramaturg in the room to provide live feedback.
Right. So I've heard of this sort of theoretical model where the dramaturg is in the room at every rehearsal. And I hear of that as being standard practice, but I also sort of visualize it as like a mythology because I've never had an experience personally or known of anybody who was like, oh yeah, well, I'm the dramaturg, so I've got a 10 out of 12 today, or this is my life for the next 6 weeks. Have you ever been that style of production dramaturg who was on hands-on and really in the room as much as the lead actor?
No, definitely not. And I'm totally fine with that. I think there are some people who really need to be in the room often, and there are some people who really don't want to be in the room at all. I very much see my role as like I'm here to be another tool for the director to get what they want, and if that means they want me in the room 2 times a week, cool, I'll be there. If that means they want me there for the first read and then nothing else, also fine, happy to do that. I would say when I did Dancing at Lunasa most recently, that was the most involved I'd been in a production. I was there for the first read, I was there for all the table reading. I was brought in about 2 or 3 times before tech week to provide feedback on runs that I was seeing,
I have
but
been
not every day. No.
okay. I've been in the room for rehearsals where like my other duties as assigned have included like, hold on, let me Google that. Like we're doing set dressing, we need to figure like what's the flag code for how we bring this American flag in at the beginning of this town hall ceremony. Like, is it okay if we walk like this? Like, hold on while I Google that.
Right.
And that was like an extension of my dramaturgical, like sort of other duties as assigned, but I was there mostly as a production assistant who kind of also did some dramaturgy. But that's the mostly what I hear about people who have those jobs, which sound amazing and like they would pay well. Just like, what would you do though, besides just be at the ready with an internet connection? Which I guess
Well,
is kind of a rhetorical question and depends on who the director is and what the need is. But
right,
answer
and
it
I
if
think
you know.
no, I mean I think I don't know the answer to it, but I have thoughts on like we did a lot of that during table read, right? And like I don't know how helpful it is after the fact, and people can certainly disagree, but like I know that as a dramaturg, I'm going to read the rehearsal report every single night, and sometimes there's going to be a question for me, and like I'm happy to respond and provide what I can, but I would find it, for me particularly, I would find it very challenging to be an objective party in this rehearsal process if I were in the rehearsal process. So I find value in not knowing at all how decisions have been made, what decisions have been made, so I can come in and say like, oh, that monologue, I'm not exactly tracking the beats there. I'm not really getting why they're feeling this way, or this relationship is a little unclear to me. And I feel like if I had the explanation from the director watching the rehearsal as to why that was occurring, I wouldn't be able to have that feedback.
I get that. Like you wouldn't, I also wouldn't feel super empowered to provide that note if I was there for the conversation about we're doing it this way, here's why. Like if you come in blind, you could kind of say you're in a better position to be able to say that didn't seem like it worked. Tell me what you were thinking. I do remember my thought that I previously lost when you were talking about the ways in which people in other industries are often, have a feeling of disempowerment and not being heard, and that we are so fortunate in the world of dramaturgy to, largely support each other. I think that is all true, but the thing that resonated for me personally with like the parallels in Sweat is dramaturgs and theater non-senior staff tend to be really grossly underpaid, which I'm sure you know, but that like, but I, you know, I'm in personally a really lean time while, while some good things are percolating and while some other great things have, I'm doing a lot of really rewarding creative work that just doesn't pay shit right now, and I'm very lucky to be able to do it, and it beats the hell out of jacking. Is that the thing that they were doing in the in I don't even know what, like I know what a jackhammer is, but I don't really super understand what factory work you would go into and jack for 12 hours a day.
So this is really interesting because, and I think it speaks to when the play was written, if I may go off on a
Yes,
tangent,
please go for it.
a sidebar. But so
It's all sidebar here.
one of the actors who was playing Stan, the bartender who has been injured and no longer works at the factory because of all the things that happened to him, said, like, what is jacking? And I was like, that's a great question. I'll find out for you. It turns out that the only definitions of jacking I could find now refer to a way in which you lay pipe essentially now by
Okay.
pushing like concrete pipe through the ground through like a hydraulic device, which is not obviously the factory work that these people were doing.
Right. But some one of the characters does talk about being in the section where they're doing something something pipe work, yeah.
Yeah, so I found a definition from a long time ago that stands on super shaky ground, but is the only thing I could find that really spoke to what they're talking about, which is jacking can also be a term where you're inserting a smaller pipe into a larger pipe by force to make them into a larger pipe. So like,
Okay, yeah.
so my best assumption is that that's what they're referring to because they do a ton of work with their hands in the script. And the one video I found from like 1984 of jacking is very hand intensive, like putting the smaller pipe in, like hammering it together, sometimes bending it. But I think it speaks to the what the play might be very upset to hear, the rapid technology addition into these factory industries, because all the information I can find on jacking now was this hydraulic way to lay pipes underground.
That is interesting. So even the definition of the job became kind of out sounds like outmoded in a real big hurry. Yeah, so as a theater person, I have not done anything to do with forcing smaller pipes into larger pipes. But I have had that feeling of, ooh, $11 an hour. Oh, $11 an hour would really be better. So I don't really know. In some ways, it is frustrating to see what feels like such a cultural divide. When the economic issues that are sometimes seem like they're d dividing political groups are kind, we're all kind of in the same boat. Like none of us super have the resources to go down to the bar and buy a single drink right this second, but probably if we could put it on credit, we'd be good for it in like 3 weeks.
Well, and another really interesting thing that, speaking of theater and speaking of economics and things like that, something a lot of some now that I'm in school again, a lot of people don't know that I already, have a master's degree. I earned a master's degree in May of 2017 in nonprofit management and social entrepreneurship.
That's right. Fancy.
Which is like, thank you, but so it's like it feels very foreign already to me. But so when I'm reading this play and I'm thinking about like the people who are underpaid and the unions, right? Like I sat through all of these conversations and the legal implications of union busting and. It's a little bit different because obviously I was studying nonprofits and these are very much for-profit corporations, but like the fiduciary duty that people do or do not have in the room to see that the organization is running to its fullest capacity. I think that more so goes to your comment about people being underpaid in theater, which I studied and have many thoughts about. I
I
think it
want to hear
also
them all, either now or at another time.
yes, but I think it also speaks to the play, right? Which is like there are real consequences to people's livelihoods, right? Like $11 an hour is great for a lot of people. $6 an hour, as the play points out, might be enough for the next person. And there's a real challenge there of who they're going to hire, right? Because you can hire someone for a higher rate and pay all of their union benefits, or you can hire this person who's going to work for half and ask for nothing but work 20 hours a day.
Yeah, work just as diligently, maybe not with as much, well, definitely not with as much experience, maybe not with as much skill, but certainly taking the job as seriously because they need the money as much. Yeah, I have worked. I think the lowest rate I ended up getting as a dramaturg ended up being, I think it was $3 an hour. I hadn't
Ooh.
super done the math beforehand when it's like, because it was one of those like, it's $100 to do this project. I'm like, oh, that sounds great. I love those things you just said, and I would love to be involved with this organization. What a great, but like all the secret, not super in the contract, like rehearsals and meetings that you end up going to. And then one day I sat down and did the math. Like, oh, I'm getting $3.24 an hour. That's not enough. Oh no.
Totally.
I'm still glad I did it. Probably would still have taken it as a but I just like I would have felt better knowing what I was getting into at the time.
Yeah.
But that's a thing that I find for freelance theater artists over and over again is that almost without exception, every job that seems like it's going to pay $33 an hour actually pays $4 an hour. By the time you go to all
Totally.
the team meetings and everything. So word to the wise freelancers, watch
Poof.
your back.
Well, and that's why, like, I was very fortunate because for Dancing at Lunasa, actually, I was not brought on until 3 days before the process because the director was like, oh no, we need a dramaturg, and they hadn't planned for one,
Oh,
and I just happened to
good
be
on that
one.
director.
Yeah, which was really great, and I was happy because I got a job, which is really lovely. But I was very appreciative, and I know that this is not common, but the artistic director of Vinnie Lancisi of Everyman said to me, like, this is super last minute. This is what we're going to pay you because it's so last minute. If our understanding of what this agreement is increases at all, if there's you're doing more than what we've laid out here because we're so unclear with what this process is going to be, like, you let me know and we'll talk about your payment,
Oh, that's
which is
nice.
really lovely. And we didn't have to do it because it was just such an open process and we were all on the same page from the beginning. But I remember thinking to myself, like, how many times have people signed on to projects that they believe one thing is going to occur and then a totally separate set of responsibilities pops up and there is no conversation about adjusting compensation for that. And I'm sure that that is unfortunately probably the norm more than the exception. Yeah.
A theme in the play that was interesting to me. Something Stan says, that character who got injured, and he has these younger characters who are talking to him about, no, I have to stay in the union. This is my family has done this, and this is where my future is, and so on. He said something about people have forgotten how to move on from a place when the well runs dry. Like it's something our ancestors had known forever, and something that really got me thinking. I had been listening to Hillary Clinton's audiobook of What Happened, so about the 2016 election, and she was talking about job plans, and particularly in areas, I think she was talking about areas where coal mining had been the industry, and her plan was to, move that into more renewable sources. But also the sort of the tension between people wanting to stay in that town where their families had been and where they had grown up versus, okay, but if we move, there are jobs. I can get trained for these very and like what does it what do we need to do policy-wise as a country to make it so that people who are in these kinds of labor jobs can get the skills they want to have the jobs they want, and then if they need to, be able to move to a new town if they want to. Like what's keeping people besides from that the nostalgia, as Stan says, like what so all anyway that as that's like a preamble to can you tell me about how nostalgia as a disease as I think Stan puts it fits into this production and your understanding of how it folds into the play and sort of where we are as a nation right now.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. And I think my answer is going to be twofold. And I first want to address what you brought up, which is the idea of nostalgia being a hindrance to many people and many kind of livelihoods that happen, especially in this play, right? Because a lot of these characters say, like, this can't happen. My mom worked at the factory. My mom's mom worked at the factory. Like, this idea that lineage equals ownership to a certain degree is really fascinating. And I think Stan, to a certain, to the one who is injured, doesn't say that he's like, I got out because I got injured. But I, in my reading of the play, there very much is a tone of like, I was dedicated. My family was dedicated. We were on the line because everyone else was on the line. And now I'm not only by virtue of my injury and only by virtue of me not being important enough for them to, when I complained the machine was not working, for them to fix it. So that's really interesting. And I think Reading, Pennsylvania is probably a really interesting case study in that, not only because I think there are a lot of people who exist in that space who have fallen victim of this rapid deindustrialization of the area. But one of the things I found most fascinating when I was doing the dramaturgy was Reading in 2006, maybe 2007, in the mid early 2000s, Reading, Pennsylvania was named as like one of the top places to move in the country because it had a low cost of living. And of course it did, as we now know, it was rapidly increasing in poverty.
That was, you said that was like 2000, early 2000s when that came out? Okay.
Yeah, so like mid early 2000s.
The beginning of the action of the play, not not from what you see on stage, but the beginning of the chronology.
So as this area is rapidly increasing in poverty rates and, you know, unemployment, people from outside Reading, and I think it was like Barbara Corcoran, who's that famous real estate person on Shark Tank, like announced that Reading was like one of the places that people, it would be a great place to move because it has all of these things. So what actually ended up happening in like from 2000 to 2010, a ton of people moved from New York City and Philly and all of these places with very high rents to Reading, Pennsylvania for these promises of better lives at lower cost of livings and things like that. And what I found most fascinating was a lot of people were immigrants or first generation Americans who were just trying to make an honest living. And with them, not all of them, I want to be very clear, but with some of them came a new opportunity for drug traffickers from these massive cities to open their world into a new market. And what's really fascinating is that because of the lack of competition that existed in Reading for a very long time, and I think it's still the case, a federal report came out in 2015 talking about how the migration of people from different areas of the country kind of opened this new drug trafficking area in eastern Pennsylvania. A gram of cocaine actually cost more in Reading, Pennsylvania than it did in New York City for quite some time because there was no competition in Reading, Pennsylvania.
It was, and just the one guy. Like,
just the one dude. Yeah. Who was selling it.
And something that one of the characters alluded to was, you know, after the, at a point when she's not working because of a strike and someone confronts her about drug use, she's like, it's for my back. And, you know, throughout the play, she's been talking about, everybody's talking about the injuries that not like, not, except I don't think it's really injuries, but the ways in which they just, they hurt everywhere from doing, you know, standing up manual labor work all day. It seems like that, like, if I were a drug dealer, I would bring all the opioids to the shutdown factory towns because, my God, physical pain is really hard to get up and over, particularly if you're in a position where you don't have health insurance or you don't have or you can't afford your copay or, like, my goodness. It becomes a survival thing to just like, okay, I need to drink this off or Vicodin this off or something so I can get to work, so I can get up over this pain and get back to being productive, which obviously is a slippery slope, but.
Yeah. Well, right. Already when these people are talking about how, oh, our 8-hour days are putting us in this much pain. And now the union says we have to cut our salaries by half and we have to work 10-hour days now. Like, that's fertile ground for people to come in and say, like, I have a solution for you.
I have a really grim way to bring this into recent news, but did you see a story that I think was in the New York Times yesterday about women who have been miscarrying because of, it's awful, but women in very similar sounding factory work, but there's a Verizon contractor in Tennessee where women had been requesting lighter duty per their doctor's instructions because they have high risk pregnancies, and it's just like no, and women are like miscarrying on the floor of these factories. And it's not just this one contractor, it's you know, places where people are pushing mattresses or, you know, an Albertsons in Atascadero. Yeah. I think I've been to that Albertsons. Not getting light duty because there aren't really protections for pregnant workers. As the article was saying, like it's only pregnancy discrimination if you would give different kinds of workers lighter duty for other reasons. But if you treat all of your employees poorly, then you're not discriminating against pregnant women. You're just shitty to everybody. And so that's perfectly legal right now. But yeah, it was just like the trail of dead babies from doing exactly this kind of work. And the thing that was so infuriating, I read this immediately, by the way, after finishing the script last night. I'm like, well, that was a lot to take in. Let's scroll Facebook for a second. Oh, wait, what's this? The spokespeople were like, this is, you know, these are allegations basically made up by the Teamsters to make us look bad. You know what who the real villain is? The Teamsters. Like, don't you talk about the Teamsters that way. In the days of my youth, I was a Teamster. When I was an attractions hostess at Disneyland, we were all local 495. I still have my two Teamster Christmas ornaments, big shiny things that go on the Christmas tree every year. I was very proud of my union membership.
That's amazing.
It was amazing. And you know, I left Disneyland after 3 years of employment with a Teamster contract at $8 an hour. This was a long time ago. But I know that if it hadn't been for my union, it would have been so much lower. I don't know how they would have pulled it off, but I knew it was going to be worse. Not because there were like villainous people running it, but it was a very fun job. I'm really glad that I had it. But I also was so grateful for those protections because there were so many employees. And if I were a person in the office looking at like, what do I need to do for my stakeholders? Well, this, you know, very part-time college kid, there are 16,000 of them, let's say. There, it's a very easy place for us to make up this deficit is just by taking 25 cents an hour from each of them. Anyway, that's a rant that's old that I don't really have a lot of expertise to get into, apart from saying that even though this play is about Reading, Pennsylvania, and particular events related to the economy during the Bush administration, there are so many strands of it that are relevant to everybody, that kind of touch everybody in America in one way or another.
I very much would say it's a genealogy play of what we're living through right now. I think there's no real way to get around that. I think if you want to see why people in the Rust Belt voted the way they did and why people in the Rust Belt feel forgotten, this play is telling you why. This play is telling you is tracking the moment that people stopped seeing their representatives care about them. Whether that was true or not, the perception was that they didn't have people who were caring deeply about them. And that translated to everything we're seeing now. This is just my own opinion, but I think it's a genealogy play for what we're experiencing today.
So with the knowledge that you're a theater practitioner and not a policymaker, what do you see as the next right step as a way forward?
Like from a theater perspective or like a global perspective? Because we could go into a breakdown about that.
I was thinking more in terms of a global perspective. Yeah, I think to the extent that you've got the answer, I want to know your hot takes on what you think a solution is rectifying some of the brokenness.
I don't know. I think it's really challenging. I guess I don't have to hide my political affiliation on this podcast.
No,
I've been trying to for some reason. I don't know why.
No, it's fine. We're all commies. We're not officially commies. We are officially bipartisan, but you know, like, as I've said on this podcast and in episodes that I don't think have been released yet, you know, I have never met a conservative dramaturg. It doesn't mean that they're not out there. I would actually love to interview one. But I think because we spend so much time looking at how all of these parts fit into the whole, and thinking about how these stories affect other people, like I would have a really hard time imagining a world in which, you were a successful, hyper conservative, thoughtful dramaturg. That's my own political bias for sure. But it's okay if you're a commie on my podcast, where this podcast is not nonprofit. It is just me being the host and saying stupid shit and sometimes some smart shit. So continue.
For I realized I was like, maybe I shouldn't say that I like indicate that I lean politically this way, but it doesn't matter. I also live in Maryland, so like there's
Yeah,
not
it's
really any
fine.
hiding.
Yeah, like I'm not worried about like losing my nonprofit status or anything. I'm just a lady on the internet.
Great. Like I said, it's not like I live in a swing state. Like live in a very reliably blue state.
Right. Well, no, you got Larry Hogan. You got I was there for that. I didn't vote for him. You're not
Larry
so
Hogan.
reliable. Everybody in Maryland, make sure you vote. It's coming right up.
Everyone in Maryland vote and think critically about who you're going to vote for because
16 days. Get in there.
16 days.
If I do upload this today, which I won't.
But I think it's really interesting because, as in the, is the case with many states, I moved to Maryland. Well, let me back up. I moved to Maryland when I was 9. We moved around a ton when I was little, but like all my formative years have been in Maryland. And I grew up in a very, very rural, conservative area of Maryland known as St. Mary's County, known
Oh,
as.
I
I don't
do. Yeah, known as and actually called. Yeah, I know them.
actually called, actually named St. Mary's County, which is as south as you can go in Maryland without being in Virginia. And it's very rural, very, it's a crabbing community, it is
Yeah,
a
that's
fisherman's
coastal, right?
community.
It's that
It's the,
southern
yeah.
Chesapeake-y.
Yeah, it is nestled between the Potomac, Patuxent, and Chesapeake. So
Patuxent. Oh man, that
it's just
sounds
like right there.
like cough syrup.
Yeah, it does kind of sound like cough syrup. But so it's very rural, very conservative. The only reason people live in St. Mary's County is either to farm or to work at this massive naval base that is some for some reason there, because I guess it's on the water.
Oh yeah, makes sense.
So everyone who lives there, most people who live there are very conservative because they're literally their lives depend on it, right? Like my dad works for the government on the base and builds things that, explode things very far away because that's what happens. So I feel like moving there and going to college in Baltimore City, which like blew my mind because in St. Mary's County, there is not a single house of worship that is not a church. That's a fact.
Wow.
And I went to
Okay.
college. Wild. Went to college and I was like, oh my God, my world is expanding and it's perfect. And I think it's the right thing I did. And it's the best thing I ever did was to go to a place that was so unlike anything I knew. But I think that kind of heavily influences how I see people interacting and how I see us as a community and country moving forward. Just because, I can go to St. Mary's County and I know people I grew up with who are still very conservative, who I may disagree with on a political level, but I don't disagree with on a moral level.
Yeah.
And I think so much of what's happening now, and I think that this play also kind of gets to the heart of, especially with the Cynthia and Tracy friendship dynamic, is the idea that we all need to get to a place where we're not morally compromised, or we don't think the people sitting next to us are morally compromised.
Yeah.
And I don't think we're there yet because in the play, right, like Tracy says the only reason Cynthia got this job is because she's a person of color. And like that's so obviously not true. But when so many things happen to you that make you believe that the person sitting next to you is your enemy and not someone who can help you, nothing good comes from that. And I think that this play talks about how that has sowed the seeds. And I think that is exactly where we are in our political climate, right? Like it's so competitive. No one is in it to help each other. We're all against each other. And I don't know, I don't have the solution for that, but I see a lot of the DNA of like how that became possible. Because I think there are both Republicans and Democrats that I probably would have a moral discrepancy with. And
Man,
I think that that's just so, it's just so fascinating to me. And that's kind of like the world that I'm wrestling with in my mind.
we're so close to being out of time, but this feels like we just cracked open like the midterm elections to something like metaphors have lost me. I didn't take all of my medicine this morning, only some of it. So I'm having some cognitive issues with words. We cracked open the dealy about politics. This all feels really relevant to this moment that we're in about a way forward. And I would love if you would want to provide me with some things I can put on a bloggy blog to accompany this podcast, not to give you any more homework, but things you already have. I'd love to kind of get the roots out farther of all the themes that are connected with this project that you're working on, this project, you know, with Sweat, because it's, you know, it is relevant as fuck right now.
Totally. And I think, like I said, like, I think that, that was a really great sentence I just said. I think,
it's fine. It's, you know, it's not like, even though it is a podcast and it is all about our words, they don't all have to be perfect because we are not working off a script. We're just talking on the internet. So keep on going.
They don't even know that we're humans. They can't even say that for sure.
I am a robot.
You're very well spoken.
Thank you. I'm very well programmed.
But I think so much. I think what this play really gets to the heart of is the idea that the problems that we're facing now didn't start in 2016. Yeah. Right? Like, mm-hmm. they were the animosity and the deep resentment that a lot of people on both sides of the aisle feel was sowed 2 decades ago. And yeah. I actually, not to get into another thing, but I just finished listening to a podcast that was about the Bill Clinton, Monica Lewinsky scandal.
Mm-hmm. What was that podcast called? Because I want to listen to that.
Slow Burn. It's amazing. Oh,
it's already uploaded. I just haven't gotten into
it yet. So good. So good. The first season was on Watergate, which is equally as fascinating.
Oh, yeah.
But, right, like, I would say that some of the, I mean, I guess I wouldn't say, we are seeing articles that came out like 2 days ago about how people feel about that scandal and how that is impacting how we're viewing people who weren't even in positions of power at that point to do anything. But, like, to ignore the fact that resentment and hostility and the circumstances with which we find ourselves now did not start 2 or 3 decades ago is, I think, negligence at best and destructive at worst. And I think that Sweat kind of, like, highlights that and makes us face, like, no, the things that we're facing now, which are very recognizable to you, yeah, these things were happening between 2000 and 2010, and this is the outcome.
Yeah, and still it's backlash from the Civil War and the events leading up right. to the Civil War, which were backlash from the way the Constitution was put together, which right. was because, yeah, you know, it was for all the reasons.
Totally.
But yeah, I'm so glad you were here with us today to talk about this project and that we were able to get it today. I'm going to try to get this up pretty soon because it is, again, relevant as fuck. Mm-hmm. Everybody vote. Everybody yes. go see Sweat at Everyman in Baltimore. Wait, Everyman or Center Stage? My brain.
Everyman.
Everyman! I mean, go see whatever Center Stage is doing, too. They're great.
Yeah, they're great.
And Lindsay, where can people find you on the internet and in the world?
People can find me on the interwebs. I'm at simply_Lindsay on Twitter. I believe I'm simply.Lindsay on Instagram. That's where you'll find all my musings on things politics, feminist, and theater. So, I mean, honestly, good. What more could you want?
Right. So there was really no pretending that you were bipartisan.
No.
Like on the fence about whether or not women are people, you know.
No. No, I like to think that existing is important, but yeah, some people may disagree.
It has its merits. And if people wanted to hire you to do dramaturgical freelancing work, is that something that you are open to?
Yes, I am a student, so absolutely.
give us $11 an hour or more. More, please, more. We have so many degrees. Oh, my God.
Yeah. Support, hopefully, future educators and professors and get us out there. So, yeah absolutely.
And so people can go to your website or reach out to you on, like, a Twitter direct message. Are your DMs open?
My DMs are
super. Okay. Lindsay Barr, everybody. LMDA administrator, dramaturg extraordinaire, available Yay. For hire, super good researcher from Maryland. Right? Is that what your business card is going to say going forward?
Yeah.
Super good researcher, comma.
I just ordered them on Vistaprint, so.
From Maryland. Thanks so much, everybody. This was The Context, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you.